Welcome to Morning Report Top Stories, a selection of news from Radio New Zealand National's Morning News Programme.
Two senior cabinet ministers are in a public scrap over the leadership of the beleaguered Oranga Tamariki. The dispute was triggered by Whānau Ora Minister Pene Henare weighing in on the future of the agency's chief executive, Grainne Moss, who reports to Children's Minister Kelvin Davis. The Māori parties jumped in too, with co-leader Debbie Ngarewa Packer saying the conflict isn't surprising, but is distracting from the real issue. Well, with more on this, our political reporter Jo Moyer is in the studio. Kia ora, Jo. What prompted Pene Henare to weigh in on this?
Yeah, good morning, Susie. Grainne Moss has been under fire for a long time. We know that. We've seen time and time again over the last few months more these scathing reports into Oranga Tamariki and its management and service delivery. There's, of course, been accusations of institutional racism, which even she has conceded to this week. Now, this has prompted a lot of speculation about how safe her job actually is. Now, when Māori Television approached on Tuesday night, they approached Pene Henare, he sort of decided to jump in, boots and all, started speculating that she'd be gone within a matter of hours and that she wasn't the right person for the job. Now, this forced Grainne Moss to have to defend herself at a press conference the next day because, of course, she was repeatedly asked if she was going to resign. Now, bear in mind, this, of course, isn't the area of Pene Henare. He doesn't have responsibility for it, but he does have a lot of knowledge in the space because, of course, Whānau Ora would deal with Oranga Tamariki a lot. They would deal with the services and he would know firsthand how it does, or in some cases doesn't work. Calvin, of course, is new to this role as Children's Minister. Now, you know, a fresh set of eyes is good, but I imagine Pene Henare could quite quickly point out where the faults are with all of this. Now, while it's out of line for him to be talking about something that's outside of his ministerial responsibilities, it's probably also a safe bet that he's actually only saying what a number, if not all, of the Labour Māori MPs actually think.
And how is Kelvin Davis, the minister responsible here, how's he reacting to all of this?
So, of course, he is responsible for this, and so it's quite a difficult position for him. He put out a pretty frank statement to RNZ yesterday, and I understand has had a very tense conversation with Pene Henare about it. Now, in that statement, he said that the comments made by his colleague Pene Henare were inappropriate and inaccurate, and pointed out that he does not speak for him as Children's Minister. Worse, though, for Kelvin Davis is he actually had to call Grainne Moss on Tuesday night after that Māori Television interview and tell her that that's not his position. Now, that would have been quite a difficult pill for Kelvin Davis to swallow, I imagine, because he's continuing to refuse to actually express confidence in her in that chief executive role.
None of this is a very good look, really, is it? So, especially, I guess, when the Māori Party back in Parliament and ready to pounce at any opportunity.
That's right. I mean, you look at Oranga Tamariki and the complete sort of lack of transformation or change that some see has gone on there, and that is exactly the sort of platform that not only returned the Māori Party, it meant that they won one of the seats off Labour, and they also got co-leader Debbie Ngarewa Packer back in as well. You know, Māori whānau and the care of their tamariki, the inequities that they've seen there within the state, it gives the Māori Party, it's a real kaupapa, it's a voice for them in Parliament to point to where Labour, and in particular its Māori MPs, just aren't delivering. Now, some in the Labour caucus, the likes of Willie Jackson and Kelvin Davis, you know, they sort of dismiss how important, I guess, and significant the Māori Party returning to Parliament is. But the point here is that it's an issue like this, like Oranga Tamariki. It not only infuriates Māori, but it also infuriates all of New Zealanders. We've seen these stories of women having week-old babies taken off them in hospitals, the inequities, the shocking statistics that go on there. And that sort of anger and frustration can quite quickly grow into a movement. And, I mean, Labour MPs, just really, they need to get on the same page, because if there's any more sort of discrepancies or conflicts like this, then that is a huge opportunity for the Māori Party.
Thank you very much. Our political reporter, Jo Moyer, there.
After nearly 20 months and multiple extensions, the high-level investigation into the Christchurch terror attack will today hand over its findings. The Royal Commission was tasked with examining what exactly security agencies knew about the terrorist before the shootings and what it did with the information. It was also looking at what could be done to prevent similar attacks ever happening again. It's still not exactly clear when the report and findings will be made public, however. And the government anticipates it will be, though, before Christmas. But for the families of the 51 Muslims killed on March the 15th, it's just another step in a long recovery. Here's our political reporter, Katie Scotcher.
Aya Alumadi is still adjusting to life without her brother Hussein.
Whilst my one and only brother Hussein is gone, it is important to me that no sibling should have to go through what I went through, and no mother or father should have to bury their child in this manner.
Hussein Alumadi was murdered as he prayed at the Al Noor Mosque in March last year. And today, the investigation into how the terrorist attack that killed him and 50 others was able to happen will hand over its report.
Just like the sentencing, the report is another piece of the puzzle that we would add to our journey of recovery.
The complexity of the investigation, difficulty gathering top secret information into the COVID-19 pandemic means the inquiry is handing over its final report almost a year later than first expected. But Ms. Alumadi is confident this means the investigation didn't overlook key areas.
Having the report back as soon as possible wouldn't have brought our loved ones back, or it wouldn't have escalated the recovery of the injured or traumatised victims. I mean, the report did take however long it needed to take to have a quality outcome, and I would rather that for the betterment of our future and safety.
The entire inquiry was held behind closed doors, and strict suppression orders mean what the Royal Commission has discovered is, for now, a complete mystery. Some of the only information that has been shared publicly is a list of some of the nearly 400 people the inquiry has interviewed, including the terrorist, the Prime Minister, and the heads of the country's spy agencies.
We definitely hope that there is thorough explanation, a lot of detail.
Anjum Rahman and the Islamic Women's Council made a lengthy submission to the inquiry and took the unusual step of releasing it publicly earlier this year. They told the Royal Commission the shootings might not have happened if it weren't for the failures of agencies like the Security Intelligence Service and police. Ms. Rahman is feeling apprehensive about eventually reading the final report.
It will be distressing for a lot of people to see where there may have been failures, where things could have been and should have been done better.
Internal Affairs Minister Jan Tinetti anticipates, but can't guarantee, the government will release the report publicly by Christmas.
I receive the report and then I will give permission for it to be released to the ministers that are involved in that, the Crown Ministers involved in that, and then it'll be worked through from there.
Ms. Tinetti says it's possible the families of the victims and survivors of the attack could read the report before the wider public, but there would ultimately be a decision made by the Prime Minister. Jacinda Ardern will also decide how much of the report is made public, but the Royal Commission has prepared it, so no redactions are necessary. A tuiti whare parimata mō te hōtaka o te atanei. Ko Katie Scott-Truaho.
The Corrections Association is defending tactics used to handle aggressive and unruly prisoners. On Tuesday, RNZ revealed that two women from Auckland Women's Prison were kept in a segregation unit for 4 months, had their cells gassed, they were made to lie face down on the ground before they were fed and had to plead for basic hygiene products. The president of the Corrections Association, Alan Whitley, told RNZ reporter Charlotte Cook why cell bombing with pepper spray is better than physically grappling with prisoners.
You discharge the can for 3 seconds. The pepper spray goes through the air into the cell, normally lands on a surface. You try for the back wall of the cell, and from that it fills the cell with atomised pepper spray. You don't spray it directly on the prisoner. They start to inhale that, they feel the effects of it, and you can then bring the prisoner out of the cell into fresh air, and the effects of that wear off relatively quickly.
What level behaviour does someone have to exhibit before that might be used?
It's used to get somebody out of a cell, sometimes for their own safety. It's been used in places where prisoners have been very aggressive but also harmful to themselves, to bring them out where prisoners are smashing up the cell. You want to get them out of the cell before they manage to smash out of the cell and come at you with a weapon. So they're the sort of examples of where we'd use a cell buster.
How do corrections officers feel about having to resort to that level of restraint?
No one goes to work with the intent of having to use any level of force on a prisoner. whether it be physical hands-on or the use of any of the pepper sprays that we've got. They prefer to deal with incidents at a lot lower level by talking to the prisoner and gaining cooperation from the prisoner. But once you've got a volatile prisoner, you do need to do something about it. And using pepper spray of any of its forms is a lesser method than actually getting hands-on and struggling and wrestling with the prisoner and pulling them down to the ground.
Do you think that cell busting should be stopped?
No. No. The other way that we get a prisoner out of the cell is quite barbaric as well. You form up a team outside the cell with four staff members in protective equipment. They have a shield. They open the door. They go in. They slam the shield against the prisoner to hold them on the wall while two people grab the prisoner's arms, one on each side. The shield's removed. The prisoner is dragged down to the ground. And then wrist locks are applied. While a fourth person gets around and controls the feet of the prisoner, you get more injuries to staff and prisoners when you have to go in and intervene in a situation of drawing somebody out of the cell in those circumstances than you do putting a dose of pepper spray into a cell. I've experienced the cell buster myself. It's not nice, but you do recover from it relatively quickly.
How often do you have to form the team to do that?
It just depends on the level of prisoners that you're dealing with. Some prisons, it could be an occurrence every couple of days. Other prisons, it could be a week or so. Other prisons, it could be months apart. It just depends on the temperament of the prisoners that are in there, because they're given the opportunity to move out of that cell peacefully. They're given several opportunities before force is used on them. So they decide the force is being used, not the staff.
Another tactic that has been talked about in this case was making the prisoner lie on the ground with their nose against the floor near the toilet to get fed. What is that tactic?
Okay, so that's not how it's normally done. So to put a meal into a cell where you've got an aggressive prisoner or a prisoner that's lashing out at a staff member, you need to open the meal slot and you need to pass the meal in or put the meal onto that meal slot. Quite often while you're doing that, the prisoner will have a crack at the staff member by throwing something out of the slot, quite often a body fluid of some sort, or they'll try and grab the staff member's arm and cause injury to the staff member. So a process that we use is having this prisoner go to the rear of the cell, they come down onto their knees, and they place their hands on the back wall of their cell. That gives the staff ample time to open the food slot and place the food onto the food slot so the prisoner can come forward and get it with the staff member being cleared back from that food slot. Why we do it that way is if that prisoner makes a sudden move to try and get up and come at the staff member, they've got a time to move away from that food slot and avoid being injured themselves. I've not heard of anybody having a prisoner lying on the ground with their nose down on the floor by the toilet.
And that is Alan Whitley, the president of the Corrections Association, speaking with RNZ reporter Charlotte Cook.
Air New Zealand staff have an anxious wait in managed isolation while scientists try to determine where the newest case of COVID-19 in New Zealand has come from. Results from genomic testing are due to be released later this morning. Now, they're expected to show whether the COVID-positive Air New Zealand crew member caught the virus in Shanghai or here at home. 14 crew members, including the positive case, returned from Shanghai on Wednesday and went straight into a government isolation facility. At least three close contacts in Auckland are also isolating at home. Savage is the head of aviation at the Etu Union and joins us now. Morena.
Oh, good morning, Corin.
Can you give us an update on the status of this individual? How are they going in terms of that this is the person who's caught COVID, the crew member?
Yeah, obviously a very stressful time for anyone who catches COVID or is asked to go into quarantine or managed isolation. I haven't talked to the crew member directly. Pardon me. I haven't talked to the crew member directly, but one of our organisers has, and they're apparently doing well under the circumstances.
So they have a number of close contacts who have also gone into isolation. Are they crew members as well, obviously?
Yeah, I'm not entirely up to date on who else has gone into managed isolation other than the crew, the Air New Zealand crew. So there are two different groups. Some have gone to the jet park into a higher quarantine facility, and the rest of the crew, as I understand it, have gone into one of the other managed isolation facilities.
Is this the first time that an Air New Zealand crew member has picked up the virus like this, the first time you've gone through this process?
Yes, there was a number of Air New Zealand employees at the start of the pandemic who were infected. Obviously, the rules were changed, the safety guidelines were improved, and there hasn't been any infection for many, many months. So this is the first time under the new regime, you could call it, the new surveillance testing model, where someone has actually been picked up as having COVID.
And are you comfortable with that routine, that surveillance testing?
Yeah, we're pretty comfortable with how it works. It shows the benefit of surveillance testing, I think, that crew are obviously very safety conscious. They take this very seriously. They take their own health and the health of the passengers very seriously. Now, they undergo quite a lot of rigorous training. They wear a lot of PPE. They self-isolate in hotels. But on top of all of those, the surveillance testing is there to pick up any anomalies or any slip-ups, any mistakes. And that's the situation we're in right now, where we're waiting to find out, if we can, via the genomic sequencing, where did this person catch COVID.
And what's your feeling? And do you think it's more likely to have come from Shanghai?
Look, I mean, I don't want to get into the conjecture of it. It's possible that it was community transmission here in Auckland. I think that's something for the Ministry of Health experts to decide. The person had been on a previous tour of duty to Shanghai prior to this recent trip. So it is possible, given that there has apparently been a community outbreak, that it was from Shanghai. So we just hope that if the sequencing can be shared between the Shanghai authorities and New Zealand, then we'll get a lot closer to understanding what, if anything, has gone wrong.
Do crew going to Shanghai feel safe enough when they get there, bearing in mind that they isolate, don't they? But it's not a full quarantine type arrangement.
Look, again, I couldn't comment. We've had no real feedback to say people are feeling unsafe there. Certainly there's been some comments about the standard of the facilities that the Chinese government put them into, in particular the quality of the food. Obviously, it's really tough time for cabin crew to work under these kinds of conditions, where as soon as they get to a destination, they're effectively isolating from the crew that they travel with, staying in their hotel rooms, and then just getting back on the flight, putting on the PPE and coming back home, and then getting tested again. So, you know, pretty tough times, particularly given that so many crew members are also facing redundancy at the moment.
Yeah, I was going to ask about the morale of staff at the moment at Air New Zealand, given the circumstances.
Yeah, it's tough work. And when we're talking particularly about cabin crew and pilots at the moment, but for the cabin crew on the 787s, around 380 of them being made redundant, and there are people in the quarantine facilities right now who pretty much on the day they get out of that two-week quarantine will be then made redundant. So this is the last 2 weeks of their job at Air New Zealand, is sitting inside a hotel waiting to see if they've got COVID.
Some hope on the horizon, though, with vaccines, that you know, that there may be an end to all this?
Yes, definitely the vaccine information and the fact that there are a number of vaccines that prove to have some real high efficacy means that people are starting to look to next year, thinking about whether or not international flying is going to come back, perhaps the middle of next year. So all of that modelling is being done, as we understand it, by the airlines. And, you know, obviously for a lot of people, really hopeful that Air New Zealand can start flying again and then start rehiring again.
Savage, appreciate your time this morning. Head of Aviation at the Etu Union. The Reserve Bank is warning the shocks from the COVID-19 pandemic have yet to be felt because of financial support measures put in place. In its sixth monthly financial stability report, the bank says the economy is in better shape than expected, but a sharp fall in house prices or a rise in unemployment are both possible threats to New Zealand's financial stability. The Reserve Bank has also announced a reintroduction of loan-to-value ratios next year to reduce the growth of low-deposit home loans. Adrian Orr is the Governor of the Reserve Bank and joins us now. Morena.
Morena.
The loan-to-value ratios, you've chosen to put them back in at 20% for first home buyers and 30% for investors. Did you give consideration to going stronger measures in particular for investors?
Well, that's exactly what we're consulting on. So we've announced what we will be talking to the banks about. We haven't physically put the ratios in yet, but the good news is the banks have moved in advance anyway, given the usual high success rate of the consultation on this topic and the end outcome. But part of that consultation, yes, of course, we can consider the levels we need to manage the financial risk posed.
Yes, because I see reports out this morning that people making large capital gains on housing, I mean, that's a pretty much given. A lot of investors wouldn't be put off by a 30% deposit, would they? I mean, do you need to go higher to 40% to try and really deter that speculation?
Well, I think it's important to understand the reason why we consider loan-to-value ratios, and that is really about making sure there's not excess leverage or excess debt borrowing in the housing market, because that's where households, whether they be investors or owner-occupiers, can find themselves in trouble. And more importantly, if banks are doing a lot of it, it becomes a very concentrated part of a bank loan book. And that means if unemployment rose or interest rates increased and people can't service those debts, it becomes the bank's problem. They have too much skin in the game. So we're saying to banks, if you can't control your own portfolio, we will put these constraints in there, and you can blame us for not lending to people rather than your own appetite.
So what you're saying then is that the LVRs are not the mechanism to stop the speculation?
I would say that they would make people take pause, but it's still not obvious that that would be the one around what happens to the marginal price of housing. There's still plenty of people in the market, plenty of people who can meet those hurdle rates of, you know, those deposit rates, both owner-occupiers and or investors. We're just saying be careful around that very high leverage, because our purpose is financial stability. We're not here to control relative prices.
Understood. The other more, I guess, turbocharged version of that is debt-to-income ratios. Now, I think the Reserve Bank in previous iterations has asked for that from the government, and the government has denied it as a tool. Do you want them as a tool in your toolkit?
We think, you know, our view, and we haven't, you know, we're dusting off the research on that, but yes would be the simple answer. You know, if we're trying to have effective tools that can head off excessive borrowing, then a debt-to-income ratio is one of those. And, you know, again, it can be used in tandem. All of these tools have trade-offs. The more tools, the more options, and the better we can.
And just for those at home who aren't familiar with debt-to-income ratios, because they're not that, they haven't been used here before, I don't believe, they are used in places like England. What we're talking about is that there would be a limit to your income. Say, I think it's in the UK, it's, what, five times your income. That's the maximum you could borrow.
That's right. You know, there's different ratios going on, but they're relatively common internationally, and they are used, again, to head off people. You know, for example, at the moment, with interest rates so low, servicing a loan has become easier. You know, that is the purpose of a low interest rate. But there is still meaning that the stock of debt being taken on becomes, you know, an equal risk. Because, for example, if you don't have a job, it doesn't matter what the interest rate level is, you can't service that loan and it becomes a bad debt. And that becomes a non-performing loan for the financial institutions and so on and so forth. So this puts a limit to it on debt to income. Our challenge, of course, is income shift, just as debt level shift. So, you know, there's no perfect tool, just as valuation shift on the loan to value tools. People keep thinking about the level of the loan. Well, actually, it's related to the value as well. So, you know, there are benefits and costs of these tools, and that's what we need to talk to government about.
Mm. Well, on the issue of talking to the government, the letter from Grant Robertson, and I think the political comments we've seen from opposition parties too, are they overstepping the line in terms of independence of the Reserve Bank? I mean, if we look at the market, it has interpreted that letter as a sign that it will now be more difficult for you to make another cut in interest rates, even if that is clearly justified by what you're seeing in terms of inflation and unemployment.
Yeah, so, you know, markets are good about guessing, you know, 15 of our next two moves. That's what markets do. But, you know, the letter itself is a very open letter. It's saying have consideration. It provides some options. And really what it's saying is, can you assist us in a whole of government effort to think about affordable
housing? Sure, but I'm sorry to interrupt, but you don't believe it has hamstrung you?
Well, it's been very clear in the letter that our objectives do not change, our operational independence is not impacted, and they want advice. So, you know, we remain completely focused on stable inflation and maximising sustainable employment, because that is the most...
Yes, and you say you do give housing consideration, but can you just explain to us what would happen if you did have to give more weight on housing? Because some economists argue that if you had to put greater weight on asset prices and housing during this crisis, then unemployment would be higher.
Yes, and I think all other things equal, that's correct. You know, so really what's been talked about is there's the high-level objectives, inflation and employment. If house prices were put in the high-level objective, which is not being considered at all, then we would be trying to hit three targets with a single stone. At the moment, we can achieve the inflation and employment, but for example, at the moment, we would be having to raise interest rates to lower house prices, which would mean all other things unchanged, higher than otherwise exchange rates, higher than otherwise interest rates, and hence lower employment and lower inflation. So there is no free lunch. There are trade-offs.
And
what is being suggested is that we have consideration for asset prices, which we currently for house price, which we currently do.
Right. So you're going to now give some advice back to the government. Will you call on them to relook at tax, which is something the Reserve Bank has done in the past, urged governments to look at things like capital gains taxes. Will you call on them to do that?
We will call on them to look at the full suite of whole of government instruments
tax.
That are available. And tax would be one, but you know, from what I understand, and I'm only seeing the popular media myself, capital gains tax, wealth tax are off the table. But there are many other tax issues in there. We will talk very openly about that. And I do want to note that the letter we received is cast in a whole of government discussion. So there is a work plan, I understand, being put in place by the New Zealand Treasury. They are the fiscal policy experts. They are the chief economic advisors to the Minister of Finance.
Can I ask you then about the bright line test, which is an existing tax on properties that are flipped, not your private home? It's currently a five-year bright line test. Grant Robinson not ruling out extending that. Would there be merit in pushing that out to, say, 10 or 15 years and making it a, well, some would argue, a quasi-capital gains tax?
A perpetual bright line tax probably does start to equal a capital gains tax, but I don't want to go into what we have not sat down and considered all of these, and I want to do it properly, holistically on the way through, because whilst people focus on capital gains, wealth tax, there are many other forms of property market intervention as well as just those two taxation levels. But you know, we need to provide frank advice with the full integrity of the team here at the Reserve Bank of New Zealand. We've been asked to do that very openly. I received the letter at the same time as yourselves after some discussion. And so we're here.
Just before we go, what is your advice to New Zealanders? You've talked about the obsession, unhealthy obsession Kiwis have with property, the media attention that property gets. This has been going on for years. What would you say to New Zealanders this morning that are still reading the papers about property, wanting to buy property, wanting to invest? What is your message to them?
I would say property, first and foremost, is a thing that you live in. It is a consumption good. It is housing. If you're thinking about it as an investment, i.e. in addition to where you want to live, then there is no free lunch. There are significant risks that come with housing and significant risks that come with debt and leverage. And one of the most significant risks is economic shocks, such as the COVID-19 virus that we're not through yet, which can significantly impact on your employment and your ability to service any debt. So debt comes with dangers, and having all your money in one egg, the eggs in the basket, all your money in one asset is high-risk speculation.
Adrian Orr, thank you very much for your time. Governor of the Reserve Bank.
You've been listening to Morning Report Top Stories from RadioNZ.co.nz.